I got interrupted in the series on Psalm 91, and I wasn't finished. I'm going back to it. But with 70 league boots and in a hurry to set the frame because I'm going elsewhere to illustrate something for your encouragement and mine after I set this frame again. Psalm 91, as you have seen over the past few weeks, has three different frames of reference, as though you're looking at three different stages in a play or a drama. There's you and me. The man who opens the psalm with his statement in his time of trouble. David. But he is type of you and me. There's the onlookers in the heavenly world. Angels, heroes of faith that have gone before. And there's a sidebar looking on of Satan and his crowd. They don't speak. We can imagine what they're going to say. But those who speak are one, two, and then the council of God and those closest around him who are looking on. David's going to speak in the first person. This onlooking band's going to speak in the third person. They speak of thee and he. And then God's going to speak of him, because he, for all to hear, those that are around him, those that are looking on, and the one that's down here in the mess, God speaks concerning this person, saying, because he does him so. Now quickly, this first person speaking, David in this case, in his old age. He faced trouble, you know, right down to the end of his life. But he developed over the years a speedier fix on what to do in times of trouble. In his old age, he gets right to it. Whatever the problem is, it's not defined. He doesn't even waste any words on it. He just needs a refuge. He needs a fortress. He needs a place to hide. He needs something to cover him. And he just, like a arrow, goes right to it. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge. I will say. His mouth gets going instantly on the solution. He doesn't waste a word on the problem. He's right to the solution. Now this series, unlike others throughout the year where I lay a foundation for faith, or where like a rifle shot, God's book zeroes in on a need and grabs the emotions and encourages, and we walk out instantly knowing God's book has spoken to us. This series of five messages is based on the premise that there are laws in the spiritual world that operate just like the natural world. This series is seeking to pound it into us that there is a way to react in time of trouble, including how we use our mouth. With the heart man believeth, with the mouth confession is made. I said a few weeks ago, I like it to become a liturgical habit that is so grooved in our behavioral pattern that the members of this church will do it the way Catholics go by and light Catholic candles when they go into the sanctuary, or the other churches or religious systems that have their liturgy that is so inbuilt before they even think of it. In a time of crises, they're crossing themselves or doing some other. Well taught, not necessarily effective for deliverance, but well taught attitude that adjusts the circumstances we face to the added dimension of our religious faith. In this case, with the heart man believeth, with the mouth proclamation is made unto salvation. I repeat Romans 9 again, or Romans 10 rather. We don't have to ascend to get him and bring him down, or descend into the depths and bring him up. The word's already nigh you, it's in your mouth. Speak it forth, for with the heart man believeth, with the mouth, literally, declaration or proclamation is made unto salvation. We hang our body with our mouth. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. If we're geared in faith to where the instant the trouble comes, instead of crying out in fear, crying out in complaints, crying out in explanation, we immediately, I will say, habitualize ourselves. I will say of the Lord, Jehovah, with all those dimensions we covered in earlier message, He is my. Every word is important. He is my refuge and my fortress, my God. There is a sense in which you grab hold of the particularity of His revelation through the name Jehovah, the one that fits your need. Be it shepherding, be it provision, be it peace, be it righteousness, be it leading, whatever. You make it yours, and in the midst of the struggle and the problems that bring fear and can only be described as giving you a circumstance in need of refuge or fortress, you say, I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him, not in anything else. Will I trust, and the word is run to the shelter of, for refuge, or lean, to put your weight on a staff. That's all he says, first person. The rest of the speech making is by the onlookers that have the eons of experience that the angels of seeing God and what He responds to and what He's looking for, and the heroes of faith who have come through the struggles like David, and he's now there, and they conclude, surely He, God, based upon His track record, surely He shall deliver thee. Third person. Surely He shall deliver thee. And there's a litany of what the deliverance will be from. The snare of the fowler, the noisome pestilence, covered with his feathers, under his wings, shield and buckler, not afraid of the terror of the night, arrow that flieth by day, pestilence that walketh in darkness, destruction that wasteth at noonday. Though 1,000 others fall, you'll still be standing. And He shall give His angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways. You could camp for years on these phrases. All that God will be to the one whose living state of conscious awareness and reaction to every circumstance is, I will say, He is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in Him will I trust. Now, you know how well you need this message. If at any time this past week, 2 weeks since I was on it, any time during this past 2 weeks, you've confronted any circumstance. Now, I repeat, the purpose of this message is to engraft a habit pattern on you. Ask yourself how many times the last 2 weeks you've confronted something. I'm guilty. You've flown off. You've reacted. You've moaned. You've groaned. You've cried out. You've agonized. You've complained. You've talked to somebody else about it. You wish you could talk to somebody else about it. And did all that before you got your mouth flapping the right direction. How many over the last 2 weeks you've confronted something and your jaw started flapping? Your mouth started going. I repeat, with complaints, with anything else before you grabbed hold of yourself in the circumstance that was threatening and said, I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God. In Him will I trust. If you didn't do that first, you need this message. You see, that's part of what brought about the problem I dealt with last week. Some of you have so luxuriated and me coming out here every Sunday and opening your eyes to something in God's book that though you've read it all your life, you never saw before, you have succumbed to the same kind of temptation, the same business on the other side of the street, of those that lust after strange flesh and can't stay with one woman, of those that are constantly seeking some new fix with a drug, those that must have something new all the time because they're so goddamn dead in the discipline responses and orderings of their life that they got to be turned on with something new every time they turn around. They can't make a relationship with one companion. They can't apply themselves and develop interests in the place that they are. They're always with a taste for something new. I've suffered this all through my ministry. And I don't like it. God gifted me. I didn't get it from Stanford University. God gifted me with an ability. In fact, there was a time when I used to preach. I still preach pretty long. But I used to preach longer. Because what I saw in God's book was so obvious to me when I read it that I kept thinking that it was equally obvious to everybody else, and I'd keep going trying to hit something that I felt justified the crowd I was talking to. It took many years for me to understand that that's the gift of teaching that God has given, and the gift of seeing by His Spirit. And that I see things instantly when I'll open a book. And many of you have watched it over the 20 years or open to a passage and begin to read. And all of a sudden it'll come alive as we go along. That's God's gift. That's why He picked me. Or that's what He gave me after picking me. The Spirit's enableness to be the teacher and to be the pastor. But it carries with it something. I grew up in the church. I can remember going an entire year and enduring the messages because the pastor never told me anything, even as a teenager, that I didn't already know or see. How many of you, some of you have read the Bible through in 62, 72, 82, the worst possible way to read it, but some of you have read it through as some kind of mission from God, or have studied the Bible for years, read the same passage, and have come here, or listened on festival, and as I've taught on the same passage, You've seen something you've never, ever seen in that passage before. Let me see your hand. And I want the hands to go up if the next question is true. And what you've seen after it's pointed out is so obvious to you, you know there's no other possible explanation. How many had that same reaction? Well, you've got a problem attached to that. It gives you a high, for want of a better term. Doesn't that give you a high when that happens? Let me see your hand again. Well, you knew truth drug addicts. You knew insight shooters, snorters. I will not be intruding in there and feel that I have been elevated to be mixed in there with your snot while you snort me. I have a way of saying things you don't forget. That's another cross I bear as a preacher. I don't know how many thousands of preachers and thousands of messages I've heard over my lifetime in the church. There's only about five that I remember. That's five. Most preachers can preach the same message every week, and you won't know it. How many know that's the truth? Because you don't know what they said last Sunday, and you won't know what they said this Sunday. And if you haven't written down the text, you won't know they're preaching the same message, because there's nothing that sticks with you that they say. How many messages do you that... Well, I won't ask for hands on this. But you that have to plead guilty, that you used to listen occasionally to Jimmy Swaggart preach, how many of you remember a message that he ever preached, and yet all of you remember him crying and confessing? Right? Very few messages I ever heard that I remember. I have a cross. You always remember my messages. I go back to the subject, instantly you know. You heard that. I'll do it differently, but it stays with you. Because when you turn a light on in a room, when the teaching opens up the book and you see something you hadn't seen before, it's like a revelation, it stays with you. Now your problem, some of you, is you want that fix every week. You don't want to do anything with it. Here I come next Sunday. Give me another one. I remember preaching in Buenos Aires. 5,000 people present. My interpreter was a striking young Argentine, very eloquent, amazingly proficient in the English, and one of the best interpreters I ever had. A few years after I left, he became the pastor of the church. He was assistant at the time. And he noticed something about his congregation. He noticed what I'm talking about now. That they got addicted to hearing something new. They'd come on Sunday morning, because they had a lot of services at that church. They'd come on Sunday morning, and they'd hear a message from the book of Daniel on prophecy. And they'd come Sunday night, and they'd hear a message from the book of Galatians on the fruit of the Spirit. And they'd come on Tuesday night to prayer meeting, and they'd hear a message on the Psalms and the life of prayer. And then come Thursday night, and there'd be a practical message on witnessing. And the next Sunday here, they'd all come in 5,000 strong, and the message would be on Jesus witnessing or taking the gospel to the Samaritan woman. On it went. And he noticed nothing ever penetrated. They just come like little birds and open their mouth, and here would come a message, preacher's heart out, and they'd nod their head and say amen, go out, and Sunday night would cancel out Sunday morning, and Tuesday would cancel out Sunday night. He built a congregation within a congregation. He decided he would take some who really meant business, and he would meet with them 3 nights a week to do nothing but follow up on the Sunday morning message. Go over it again and again, apply it until it would take root in the life. Now that was twisted all out of context and became the discipleship movement that pushed about 10 years ago into cultic overtones and spread across Australia and spread across America. Once again, I'm in the history within the church that I've been a part of. I've been at the springboard of so many of these various movements. But the starting point of that discipleship movement, picked up with the New Wine magazine in Florida, was this pastor, assistant at the time I was there, who recognized what I'm talking about today. The tendency to never apply. Just become a gourmet. Just come in here and look like the actor who was a great gourmet cook who played Perry Mason. What's his name? Raymond Burr. A church full of spiritual Raymond Burrs. Well, you're becoming a burr under my saddle, and I don't like it. You're not applying what's been taught. That's your problem. It grieves the shepherd, but it's your problem. It becomes a problem to me when you think you have some ownership right in me to where you can criticize if I don't come every Sunday and open your eyes to some new truth. Oh, isn't that wonderful? Oh, that's glorious. Oh, I never saw that before. Oh, hallelujah. And then go out and do nothing all week long. Bring your goddamn lonesome ass in here and sit it down and look at me and say, do it again, Pastor. Well, up yours. This whole year, I've been hammering home the same foundation truths that I spent 20 years laying here. And some of you are retards. And it's time you look in the mirror and recognize the fact I am a goddamned, possibly on my way to hell, badass, spiritual, fluke, retard. Because all I do is take in. Well, we stuck with him while he took on the women last Sunday. How dare him get on our case today? Because you're guilty. You got it coming. Why don't you get mad when you look on television and see the mobs on religious TV? They hardly qualify as eating at an ice cream parlor. They're eating at garbage dumps. And yet, somebody's going out there and inviting and compelling and getting people to come and partake of the wonderful garbage dump. I mean, why shouldn't I be mad? They sell garbage better than you sell the best food anybody can eat from God's Word. You are a failure. Oh, you don't want to applaud very well on that, do you? I don't care. Oh, sure as hell not fight cow cranes and all the traffic and come down there to make the pastor feel good to get treated like this anymore. Well, why don't you just get up and go now so I can mock you with the camera? Too comfortable. I've suffered this cross all through my ministry. Oh, he's the most wonderful teacher in the world. What am I supposed to do? Deny that you say that? Well, proof's in the pudding. If I am, as you say, I'm not convinced, though I work at it. If I am the most wonderful teacher in the world. Of course, you're going to put a caveat on that. He is up until today when he started telling us off. If I am the most wonderful teacher in the world, and the light that I'm turning on is the most wonderful truth in the world, what do you think God's going to do to you? You know it. You ain't telling anybody. Well, I've told my friends they won't come. Well, get new friends, idiot! Anybody that won't come here with you shouldn't be your friend. What's that got to do with the message? I'm telling you, I have no intention today of titillating you by opening up some new truth. I want the truth I've been hammering for the last... Now, this is the fifth message on this subject to sink home. When are you going to start saying the right things first? When is your first reaction? Don't you think God sits up there and says, how many... I bet he says it like this. How many frickin' times do I have to deliver him before he says this first? God wouldn't talk that way. No, he'd talk words. You know, the first thing I'm going to... When I get to heaven and learn the language up there, I'm going to learn the cuss words first. It's the way I study every language. He's sitting up here in the book of Hebrews. You can read it. The book of Hebrews. Same kind of scenario. He's sitting up there. And he's complaining. Saying that these people did nothing but complain, and he determined that they would not partake of the promise. His wrath was stirred up. And he says, I won't let them go into the promised land even though I brought them out. Third chapter of Hebrews. Wherefore, as the Holy Ghost saith today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts, as in the provocation and the day of temptation in the wilderness, when your fathers tempted me, proved me, saw my works 40 years. Wherefore I was grieved with that generation, and said, they do always err in their heart, and they've not known my ways. See, these people are commenting because they know His ways. They know what His ways are. And they see David quickly doing what will move God, and they say, surely He will do thus and so for thee, because they knew His ways. These people got God upset. I was grieved with that generation, said they do always err in their heart. They've not known my ways. That's why I didn't like that song earlier. I mean, there is a limit to where sweet Jesus will put up with 2 out of 3. I mean, I'd maybe like the song if they'd say after 40 years, now thanks be to God because of His love, it's 1 out of 3. God does get fed up. You can't carry Him around this sweet Jesus little head bobber thing that you pat on the shoulder once in a while and say, okay, I did it again, God, but you know, You always give me a 2 out of 3 ratio. They do always err in their heart. They've not known my ways, so I swear in my wrath. He gets mad. I swear in my wrath. They shall not enter into my rest. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. Exhort one another daily. That's what I'm doing right now. Some, when they had heard, did provoke. And He sware they should not enter into His rest. In verse 19, we see they could not enter in because of disfaith. Not unbelief, just disfaith. Apistis. The reverse of faith. God gets fed up with it. Now, I'm telling you, this congregation, God's going to snatch me from you. You're not going to get rid of me. And when there's a fight brewing, I'll do my job. But I don't intend to spend the last years of my life teaching an overfed bunch that just wants to suck it out of me and bottle it up and do nothing with it. I'm dealing with the problem, and I'm cutting whatever good flesh I have to cut out with the bad flesh. But I always have to ask the question, who's going to be the next go-around that thinks that I'm their little talking head that must be here 24 hours a day just for you? And you do not share my passion to respond to what God has done, making this the only voice in the history of mankind that's heard 24 hours a day everywhere on this globe with the message of faith and grace and peace. If you take that for granted, you're not worth sitting here with God's grace of mission revealed to you. Comes the commission, which means with mission, where we share. God can do His work with angels. I've not laid a trip on you that you should go out every day and win someone to Christ. I make it easy for you. You've got the most beautiful cathedral in town. You have a setting. Anybody that you cannot attract to come here once to see that Bible collection is too dumb to run with you. Surely you agree with that. Anybody. Anybody that would not bring their kids while the pastor takes them to the best museums in town, where you parents ought to take them, cares nothing for their kids. And most churches you go to, you've got to be embarrassed about something. Either they let the congregation act like they're at a rock concert with no respect for God's house, or you've got some idiot violating Paul's admonition. They'd rather speak one word, understood, in the presence of outsiders who come in, and 1,000 words in tongues. You got people one-upping one another spiritually and showing off. And when that sideshow is finished, you usually got a preacher before he gets done will say something that embarrasses you. No one has seen more in the revival movements of America alive today than I have. You have the most ideal setting to invite guests of any church anywhere in the world, bar none. And you sit there like selfish, spoiled brats and drink it in. Isn't it wonderful? He's my pastor. We get this wonderful teaching. Well, you have a responsibility, folks. You better start taking it. Because I don't intend to spend the rest of my life pouring out to a group who thinks. I don't know where this woman went bad. But somewhere along the line, she got the warped idea that I existed to feed her. And I existed to feed her if she turned into nothing but an immovable blob with an opening. I don't do anything with a blob like that. Now, this was not my message. I didn't plan any of this. You just got it for free, so you owe me even more. The message was to say, apply this teaching and get to it as your first reaction. I will say, but I've been saying for the last 3 weeks, David didn't get there in one step either. That's the encouraging thing I want to give you today. David didn't make it in one step either. So we took you to the cave of Adullam. Today I want to take you to Psalm 31 and close this message as I show you that it doesn't happen overnight. But as you study David's Psalms, he is always getting closer. Each new crisis brings him closer to this finished, mature level of Psalm 91, where he finally got it, where his first reaction is, I will say of the Lord. That didn't happen overnight. I showed you in Psalm 56 and 57, when he disguised himself at Gath and feigned madness and escaped with that act, and then ended up in the cave of Adullam, where he was surrounded by everybody that was in debt, discontented, and distressed. And in that circumstance, he wrote Psalms 56 and 57. It took him a while to get quite a ways down in the Psalms, to get to the point where he was putting his trust in the Lord. But he got there, and God then came through, which fixed his faith a little better. Unlike the Israelites that God had to abandon, who never got it in their head that God's ways and His constant performance is supposed to bring us up a step or two to where we don't take as long to come to the point of faith in the next crisis that He lets us fall into. Psalm 31, the circumstance is the betrayal by Absalom. He's not as old as Psalm 91. He's not as old as that scene where he had to put Solomon on the throne that we looked at last Sunday. But he's in mature age. He's settled into his kingdom. He has expanded it from Mesopotamia to Egypt. And the son of his love, Absalom, betrays him. And that's what I found, by the way, in this current crisis. There's always somebody that seeks to exploit what they perceive as a weakness of a leader. And they always will play the Absalom role. And there's an Absalom in this context too, but I've been pretty good at dealing with those also over the years. I won't even bother you with it. But in David's case, Absalom was sitting at the gate, catering to the people's wants, listening to their troubles. And he was saying to them, David ought to be here. You need the king close to you. You need the king looking out for you. You need the king here as a garbage pail, so you can always have him close by to dump your crap on. He didn't say it that way. He made it sound like a glorious excursion. David ought to be here. And it says he won the hearts of the people. Fickle hearts. Let me tell you something. I like it when your hearts lean toward me. The fact that your heart leaned toward me during my time of crisis weakened me a bit. Thank God this little trouble has got me straightened out, because I don't care as much about your hearts as I do your soul. My job is to watch out for your soul, not your heart. Is that clear? Hearts are rather easy to win. Hirelings and quislings, flatterers and con men can do that. And he conned them. He won their hearts. He won Judah over. He had a legitimate criticism as far as the Judahites were concerned, because they always resented the fact that David moved the capital from Hebron, the old spiritual center of the tribe of Judah, to Jerusalem, which was in the tribal territory of Benjamin, when the southern kingdoms would unite in later years. Benjamin and Judah and Levi would become the kingdom of Judah to the south. But when David united them all, it took him almost 7 years to get the allegiance of the northern tribes who still wanted to follow Saul's descendants. But when he united them all, he moved the capital from Hebron to Jerusalem. They didn't like that. So Absalom knew that. And he got very spiritual. He asked David if he could go down to Hebron to pay some spiritual vows. His real reason for going there was to plant poisonous seeds of discord with the Judahites, and he won their allegiance. And he finally was able to marshal an army against David, and you see David fleeing Jerusalem. He's fleeing Jerusalem as being cursed by one associated with Saul, and he has a small band that go with him, loyal to the end. He knows exactly, for I taught several messages on this, he knows exactly, give him credit, as he's fleeing in despair, the one that he loved, Absalom, has turned on him. He's fleeing the kingdom for his life. He goes to Mahanaim, and I've done this several times. This is the Mediterranean, the Turkish Peninsula, Galilee, Dead Sea. He goes to Mahanaim because in the geography of the land, things that God did in the drama of dealing with his people were marked with names that had meaning that conveyed the happening of that occasion in that place. So the land itself and its place names became a Bible reminder of this is the way God is. Mahanaim was the place where Jacob had learned that when he was facing Esau, and Esau's bands outnumbered his, there was another band, another host to contend with, the invisible host of God's army that would be with Jacob. And he named the place Mahanaim, two hosts. Mahanaim, two hosts. When David was facing certain defeat when the armies of Absalom threatened and were overpowering. And he looked at his little band. He went to Mahanaim. It would remind him in his time of broken faith, there are two hosts. And God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And those same two hosts, the ones we see and the ones we don't see, are available for God's children today. He obviously didn't immediately go into gear, I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge. He had to make this side trip to Mahanaim, as you do when you come to the cathedral, literally to be reminded of God's promises in order that you might act on them. And in that circumstance, having been reminded that God has a host available for us, he wrote, among others, Psalm 31. That's the setting. Notice, he doesn't immediately come to it, I will say. It takes a while. He says, "In thee, O Lord, do I put my trust?" He's sort of tentative. "Let me never be ashamed." Well, there's that possibility. And he's asking that it doesn't happen. "Deliver me in thy righteousness. Bow down thine ear to me. Deliver me speedily." He's not yet to that faith, I will say. He's sort of tentative. He's rocked. He's facing circumstances that crush, and he's working his way up to it. Then he says, "Be thou my strong rock." The word is jazur in the Hebrew. Literally, they have strong rock. The Hebrew is refuge. It's "be thou the rock of my refuge," literally. Again, it should read, and you can correct it, "Be thou my house of fortress. For thou art my rock." The King James uses the same word in the second verse and the third verse. But the Hebrew has two words. Right for the first word, rock, just a rocky wall or cliff. That's what the word means, tazur, in Hebrew. The second word translated rock, "for thou art my rock," in the third verse, is selah, which is a separated crag or a pinnacle or a cliff-like crag. A little different than just a cliff or a rock. An isolated, separated. You've seen these ads on TV down in the Southwest, these great crags that stand in isolation. The only way you can get to them is helicopter or up. That's the word that's secondarily used here. They use one word in the English to translate the two words in Hebrew. And then, strangely enough, they say house of defense in the second verse. And they say my fortress in the third verse, when it's the same word in the Hebrew. So, for the first rock, put cliff. For the second word for rock, put crag, and you'll be closer to the translation that's accurate. And for house of defense, strike out defense and write fortress, because it's the same word translated fortress in the next verse. Now, having done all that heavy stuff, watch the tentative development. He says, "Bow down thine ear to me," as if God wouldn't be listening if he didn't attract his attention. "You may be having your ear elsewhere, God, but lean it toward me now." Okay. And then God has to say, "Shut up, all the rest of you guys. He wants me to listen to him now. Bow down thine ear to me. Deliver me speedily. Be thou my rock of refuge. Be thou my house of fortress to save me. For thou art my crag." Thou, as a separated rock for me, thou art my resting place like an eagle who perches in an isolated crag, and my fortress. Therefore, for thy name's sake, lead me and guide me and pull me out of the net and save me. What's the point I'm making? You don't get to this point in one step. I've been illustrating that. I've illustrated it again with a lot of side roads that I thank God I had the time to get in. You don't get there in a step. But David, the man after God's own heart, kept getting closer. From crying and complaining in the earlier messages about his circumstance and spending a lot of time talking about the garbage of his problem, eventually he would get to claiming God's help and faith and trusting in God and leaning on Him and fleeing to Him for refuge. And when he did it, God always responded. Now in this 31st Psalm, as I lead us by the hand, we got it sort of midway. Now he's not spending a lot of time about his problem. But he has to sort of brainwash himself into fresh understanding of what God is. You are a rock. You are a fortress. You are my rock. You're my fortress. Bend your ear down and listen to me. I'm going to try it. I mean, always before, if I could get another little figure, he runs around on the edge of the bank before he even gets out of the faith. Now he's sort of tentative, like somebody stepping on something that's not, he's not sure it's going to hold. So he's got to stand there and sort of pump himself up, like the karate guys go, "Hard, hard, hard!" You awake now? Are you following what I'm saying? Isn't it just like you and me? And where are you now? My problem is I'm tired after 20 years of preaching these truths, of moving slower than David. I'm tired of seeing this dark problem first and saying, "Bow thy ear, God, let me dump the garbage in your head first." That's where we were. Now he's closer, but he's still not in solid faith. He has to work up to it. Bow thine ear. Deliver me. In thee, O Lord, do I put my trust. Let me never be ashamed. Don't let me down. I hope to hell I'm doing the right thing. Are you with me? This is supposed to be a practical lesson in how to act in ways to get God's response. Thank God he did respond. Even when David was running around moaning and groaning, then he'd grab himself and say, "Oh yeah, but God's able." Now he's saying, "I'm going to try this finally, God. But don't let me be ashamed. Thou art a rock. Thou art my rock. Thou art a fortress. My fortress. Now be my rock. Be my fortress." What a contradiction. You are my rock. Now, will you be my rock? You are my fortress. Will you be my fortress? Come on, while you're laughing, that's what you're all guilty of. You mouth these things like theological creeds. Thou art, oh great, thou art. You sat there and chills went up and down as the song was sung. How great thou art! If it was another church, you'd have been running up and down the aisles. And you walk out of here, and you get knocked flat by an ant. Oh, how great thou art! Can you just prove it? And he does. That's the amazing thing. He does. But somewhere, after enough times, he wants you to learn what these people know before you get there. Do you follow that? They know before he says it that when he says, I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge, my fortress, my God, in Him will I trust. They know. That's like pulling open the trap door of blessing. They know. He's going to act. Apparently, it took a lifetime, but apparently David finally got past moaning and groaning, finally got past tentative approaches, and finally got to the spot where when the avalanche landed, he didn't even blink. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge, my fortress, my God. In Him will I trust. I hope you understand that any one of you and me, we can attain this state, and we ought to be pressing toward that mark all the time. We're entitled, this pastor's entitled after 20 years, to know that there's some growth. That's why I was beating on you as mature saints earlier. Don't just sit there like a blob and wait for the crises to come and then have no resources of faith. Practice on a daily basis that no matter what hits you, start here. I will say, and watch as these people say, watch God perform, because Psalm 91, you know, closes. And I read it again. Psalm 91 closes, because He has set His love upon me, therefore will I deliver Him, and I will set Him on high on that craggy rock. Because He hath known my name, He shall call upon me and I will answer Him. I will be with Him in trouble and I will deliver Him and honor Him. And with long life will I satisfy Him and show Him my salvation. If that's what you want, then discipline yourself to start here when the next problem faces you. That's my message.